Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
If you're a reader, then you know the joy of discovering books. You also know that some of those discoveries stand out. Yes, there's the pleasure of finding a good book, and there's even those rare occasions where you find the right book at the right time in your life, the one that somehow shapes or bolsters who you are or will be. And then there are those other moments, where the book you find feels more like you've uncovered a hidden gem. You're Keats, on first looking into Chapman's Homer, feeling like Stout Cortez, discovering a new world. In my case, the feeling resembles something less epic and more out of Indiana Jones, as though descending into the shelves of the Strand Bookstore in New York or Powell's Books in Portland, I emerge with a lost treasure, a forgotten totem or relic. It's a great feeling, one I love sharing with other readers. And that was very much my experience with Mark Ealing's new collection, River Dead of Minneapolis Scavenged by Teens. Finding it was a matter of luck. I'd come across one of his pieces online months ago, and I'd found it both strange and compelling. And then a writer who knows us both invited us to speak about an emerging genre that she calls the visual essay. And then, on the very weekend we spoke, after Ealing gave a performance of his work that was somehow hilarious and moving, I learned he was launching a new book. I immediately ordered a copy, and I was not more than a few pages in before I heard that Indiana Jones theme resounding in my readerly brain. Ealing's work is weird and rich and intriguing and odd and wholly its own. And it's a joy to say to readers like you, you have to check this out. Mark Ealing, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you for having me, Eric. Great to be here.
It is fantastic to have you here, and I cannot wait to introduce listeners to your new book, River Dead of Minneapolis Scavenged by Teenagers. It's a fantastic title, and what's in the book is just fantastic as well. But before we get to that, we've got to just give listeners a sense of your background, because this is a book of nonfiction. It's a book of graphic art. It's a book of found objects. There's an artistic vision in it that's not something that you encounter every day, and that's part of what makes it so wonderful. Where do you come from, Mark Ealing?
That's a whole bunch of nice things that you said, and I'm just going to grab them in a net of thanks and say, first of all, thank you for those kind words. The book is a crazy hodgepodge, and as it relates to me, is a subject or an area of knowledge that I currently have almost no access to. I'm still trying to figure out on a daily basis what myself has to do with the art. And maybe the easiest way to get into that is to talk about the art first instead of me. I think all the things that you said were spot on. The book is largely a collection of found things, overheard comments from relatives, things I've heard on a bus, facts I've read. And the only way, to my mind, that I was able to write that was not as a straight book of nonfiction, but as a sort of a book of voices. So I would take those nonfiction moments and put them in the mouths of puppets, so to speak, and then have those puppets say things. And I guess now that I'm speaking about this a little bit, maybe I can more directly answer your self question and say that's if I think to myself, geez, what is it like to walk around? And does one try to take those things that you see in life and try to somehow send them through the art pipeline and turn it into art? I think the book kind of replicates my experience of living. Kind of random, seeing little snatches of things here and there, and then coming home at the end of the day and saying, well, that was strange. So I don't know if I answered your question, but that's somewhat of the self-book link.
Well, you've written elsewhere that you're an avid journaler. And I want to make sure that the readers or listeners understand that this isn't journaling, right? This isn't a somebody's found journal that we've got here. There's a compression at work. There's a kind
right.
of this thematic theme that comes back. So I'm wondering about that process of, you know, here are my scraps of the day that I'm kind of jotting into a journal, which I think a lot
right.
of us do. And what sort of somehow makes it through that sieve and gets the compression and transformation that's going on in this book?
That's a great question. And you talk about the journal and from that habit, keeping a notebook, I truly have to thank my first mentor and writing teacher. His name is Lon Otto. He taught at the University of St. Thomas. And he had us, by the way, he's an amazing writer, taught me a ton. But the most valuable thing I took from his class had to do with a writerly practice where he just called it the Journal of Concrete Observations. And he was very careful to tell us and make the distinction aware in us, this isn't a journal where you write down your thoughts and feelings. You know, dear diary, X came over, afterward I wept. It's not that type of thing. It's not a record of your sort of inner turmoil or your thoughts even. What it is the place where you use your sort of ears and eyes and sense organs like a kind of body camera and record all the things that are captivating. And it's amazing how much the self, the person gets stripped out of it. I mean, I think there's an interesting discussion to be had about what kind of self emerges when you look at the entirety of what a single person chooses to observe. That's certainly interesting and may shed light on a person or selfhood or you know, what a looker or observer is when they're doing that stuff. But I found it liberating. I didn't have to weep, tear hair, get involved in my own messy inner junk. There's a calmness in being a camera and in just paying attention to the world. And as I gathered those things, I mean, all the way back in, you know, what would that have been, 94, 95 or something like that, starting that practice, you just look back on it and the moments are so specific. They take you back to that place, that time, and they're charged with energy. And I think more straight ahead or maybe technically better writers would be able to take those moments and like sprinkle them into a classically plotted narrative. And I couldn't do that. All I could do was just sort of serve those little moments up on platter, sort of moment to moment, saying, here's this thing. How about this oddity? Oh, look again over here. And that's the way I've written ever since.
So one way I'm hearing you describe this, and I think it makes sense, is that it's this kind of curio cabinet that has been
exactly.
assembled.
Exactly.
And you can tell a lot about the curator of a curio cabinet from what's inside it. A self emerges, like you were saying. And also
yes.
each individual facet has its own kind of gravity and attraction, and the collection as a whole starts to do so.
Right. Thank you.
What I don't want to come across, though, is this is not a book that reads like somebody's scrapbook or a junk heap. I mean, there's a real sort of integral vision. And so I'm wondering if there's a way you can describe to readers the experience of the book. You know, one of the challenges I think that we're going to face is that so much of the power of these pieces is visual. There's a wonderful textual sensibility, but the visual impact of it is very unusual. Have you ever been asked to describe your own kind of aesthetic in a positive way? Not the, I couldn't do the classic essay, so I did this thing that, you know, less talented writers do. I think that there's a tremendous amount of a talent and aesthetic integrity in here.
Well, that is super kind. There's three comments that came out. The first one is, how do you say what you're all about with not slagging on yourself? And that may be impossible. I was raised Catholic, and so a high degree of shame and guilt and self-laceration usually goes along with the whole thing. Just kidding, of course. So that's sort of hardwired. I tend to not try to gaze upon my own, motives too much. But you had two other comments that were interesting. One was about visuals. How do the visuals play into the book? And the second one was about how does this book not seem random? If one works out a collage collecting fragments – Is there a way to present those fragments that isn't just pure chaos? And there is. So, you know, I'm glad that you kept me honest to that. So I'll address that point first. So, a lot of these found bits appear all over the book, and only one piece in particular serves them up as discrete collaged fragments surrounded by empty space. That's truly the only piece in the book, and it's called Notes Toward an Essay on the Meaning of Art. But the other ones, they tend to come to life, and I think this only happens in the process when I'm arranging these things. Sometimes the sequence of fragments, you'll say, well, you know, there's just no way to go ahead other than present them. And so you chop them up, you surround them by space, and it's almost like touring some sort of curio cabinet, like you mentioned. The others, I found that there's a great deal of energy and interest from a continuous voice. Now, I'm not a writer that gets into characters much, or like believes in characters, as someone would say, oh, you know, I've created this person and he's a, you know, middle-aged man with a dark past, et cetera, et cetera. But what I do like is the voice, a voice that has a purpose for speaking. And maybe the voice is confusion, maybe it's anger, maybe it's some sort of inchoate mixture of emotions, but that voice needs to talk. And it's usually a question of marrying the right kind of voice to those collage-y fragmentary details that we were talking about. So that's how a lot of those pieces got written from the text component. We can talk more about that later if you'd like. For the visuals, it was the same kind of collage process, but I was really drawn to these high contrast black and white images that felt like theater. I've worked in theater. I've loved the experience of going into a darkened room and having a sort of magic sensation of, wow, something is about to happen. There's going to be an experience. There's going to be a special moment. And in a way, these little comics panels felt to me like little theaters. And precisely because so much of the book contains real stories, except spoken through the mouth of these, you know, so-called puppets, I wanted the pictures to have that same sense of realism. And so almost every single image in the book is a found image from archives, mid-century trade magazines, things of that nature. So I looked in books like American Metallurgy and Chemical Week from the 60s and Hotel Motel Monthly, and found a whole bunch of strange seeming innocuous photos of people standing around, but that felt like they could be sort of shadowy analogs to the voices that were speaking in the book. So that's a very vague way, I think, of describing the relationship between word and image, but that's some of what's happening there.
It gives us a very nice sense of the process that you're using. And just to give listeners a sense, you know, none of the characters, except on rare occasions, have faces. Their faces are stripped, right? So they're kind of masked, and which is lending a very forceful gravity to the voice and what they say. There's this opportunity to kind of project in. It seems like the book invites the narrative impulse, but resists it at the same time.
Right. That's all more well said than I would ever say myself, and really on point. I'm glad you talked about the faces. You know, these images of people from the 50s, you know, 40s, 60s standing around in various poses, juxtaposed against these words. I ran into that problem that you hinted that sort of lies in wait. If you have faces, number one is my artistic talents are limited. And once I get up in a human face as a person holding a pencil, unless I own up to my badness, the drawings get really weird. It's that, have you heard of that thing called the uncanny valley ever? Is that phrase familiar?
Sure, sure.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, it's, you know, I think people use it with like realistic human likeness robots, where they say, well, you know, if you're looking at, you know, there's a spectrum of robots that look like people. You know, if you have like R2-D2, who's ostensibly got like a cyclops eye, but largely doesn't look like a person, he's somehow cute and lovable because he's not trying to be human. But if you see a very realistic robot face that something is slightly off. It just looks horrifying. That's what people say is a thing that falls into that uncanny valley where it's so close but just a hair shy of total 100% likeness that we recoil, that there's something about our knowledge of how things should look, how faces should look, that you just sort of you are repulsed by it. And I don't have great skill. I'm not a good draftsman. And so it was both like a practical issue. I said, okay, I don't need to do faces, number one, because I'm not that good at it. But secondly, it also really served the exact purpose that you talked about, which is that with the blankness of faces, like in I used to see these George Siegel sculptures. I don't know if you know who that is, but he sort of does plaster casts of people and arranges them in situations, and he paints them all matte colors, usually white, so that details are very hard to see. It's sort of like a person can then, watching that featureless face, kind of get into the inhabit the character or inhabit the world without feeling like they have to read what's going on in that world. And I think that allowed for space for the reader to come in with these featureless faces, that readers could feel free to imagine what's going on a little bit more instead of a really specific face telegraphing what's happening. And finally, it left room for the words. I'm a writer probably first and illustrator second. And I think having space for the text to feel like it was playing a large role was necessary. And I think if I had the heavy data of a face on a page, it would crowd out the words, I think. So yeah, it's both a practical issue and a theoretical issue, I guess.
You can imagine that, right? Here's the way I solve the problem as an artist, and it ends up having this aesthetic effect,
right?
But I do want to circle back to this issue of realism, because in a couple of the discussions that have been out there about the book, people describe it as like a surreal collection or something like that,
right? Right.
And this is going to be it's going to be a kind of unfair question, because in that essay that you mentioned, Notes Towards an Essay on the Meaning of Art,
yes,
there are these series of vignettes that could be aesthetic, that could be like little scenes or things.
Right.
And because of the way the piece is laid out, it feels like they're a little bit meta, a little bit descriptive of the kind of art that's going on. And,
right.
You know, so to give listeners fair warning, like one of them is about the description of creating a breakfast tornado, which is almost breakfast sandwich.
Right.
So that's kind of one metaphor for art and perhaps the art making that you're experiencing in the book. But you do kind of go, you know, high art at one moment, and you quote Brock, you know, the co-founder of Cubism, and you quote his line, "I'm aiming for realism."
Right.
And that kind of haunted me at that moment. I thought, is this some alternative way of achieving realism?
I sure hope so. This really cycles back to you know, what you and I were talking about, self, and you know, not just me, but anyone who makes things, you know, any art maker, and heck, other disciplines as well. You know, you're this person that you are with your family and friends, and you're alone in times, and you're just seeing and experiencing or projecting things. And you're always trying to square that up with what you make. To me, you know, the gap is always large, because, you know, as you know, making things, it's hard. It's a lot of reaching toward an ideal that we all fall short of. And I think, you know, in that mix, with this, especially with comics or alt comics or literature, you know, avant-garde literature, man, if you can't get any money for anything, if you're not doing it for commerce, you should at least try to do it out of a sense of truth of what it's like to experience things in the world. And to be honest, that's, you know, a mixture of strangeness and dreams and half lies and half facts. It's always felt to me for me personally, a better way to capture experience than to, you know, straight up tell a very factual or completely fabricated story. And probably that's owing to just the experience of walking around. You know, you hear things out of people's mouths, and they're pure. You later come to learn they're pure lies, but they were told in an interesting way, in a certain mood that stuck with you. And so, even if the truth of what that person said disappears, the emotional truth remains. So I sure hope so. Yeah, it'd be fun to create a new genre of nonfiction made exclusively out of dreams. that'd be very fun.
I think the way you describe it, it makes me think not so much of, you know, naive realism where we think of like the typical novel that tells a story where you pretend you're behind the fourth wall as the characters
right.
unfold, but something like unnaive realism. Like, this is the way that minds work, and reality is perceived in a very fuzzy and multi-veiled way. And if you can somehow capture
right.
that, you're getting better. A better representation of it than if you just pretend that it's all straightforward and projected on a screen.
Well, absolutely. And gosh darn it, if there aren't some great works that do that straightforward presentation that still transports you. I mean, I can't possibly slag a style because, you know, anyone who does it well gets you to that magic place. But I've more often than not, I really feel exactly what you're saying, that I think you mentioned, and forgive me if I'm misremembering the way you phrased it, but kind of you're talking about like accessing a mind or accessing a consciousness. And to me, picking up a book, that's really always been one of the most exciting things, is not that someone's putting on a grand story for you to get lost in, but that you're encountering like a real and odd human brain, or a human soul, for lack of a better word. And you're like feeling in like you just get plugged into a brain. And this book is a medium for that. And anything that delivers that you know, connectivity really quick and in the strangest, you know, possible way, that's always seemed exciting. So that's a great phrasing. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Well, I would love it if at this point, I know the book works on a visual level very well, but if you'd be willing to read a piece, I would imagine people are curious by now.
Sure.
what we're actually talking about, and if there's a way at least to give some taste of that.
Sure, absolutely there is. I could do a few things, and I guess one is I'll read, well, it's one of the shorter pieces in the book. It's called The Sound. And it's probably a good example of a voice that is coherent on the page, but it's actually, from my perspective, just collaging a series of disparate things that I'd heard and seen. And so maybe it reads more straight ahead than all the stuff that we're talking about, and without the images. It certainly will be a different experience than reading in the book, but I'd love to start with that one. Should I just fire into it?
Fantastic. That would be great.
Okay. This is called The Sound. I was drinking with friends at the Nightcap in 1998 when one of them, his name is Daniel Tripps, began to make a lowing sound, or a sound that could be characterized as bovine or having the quality of animals or livestock. Prior to this moment, the moment when I first heard the sound, I sensed that the evening's conversation had already left him behind. He slouched. He stared out the window. He did not speak or look at the group, and as a consequence, he seemed to become invisible. I almost didn't hear the sound. It was faint. The bar was loud, and he seemed to expel the sound largely into the palm of his hand that was supporting his chin. But I did hear it. The effect was alarming. I have earlier described the sound as bovine or cow-like, but as I listened, I discovered the sound itself was comprised of three distinct and recombinant vowel sounds, moo, ma, me, each one varying slightly in duration and frequency, almost as if the sound was an emergent proto-word or a test pattern for speaking. At some point, conversation pulled me in. I disengaged from Trips, and when I next glanced over, he was gone. My father fell down and broke his hip. This was unrelated and happened weeks ago. While hospitalized, my father began temporarily to see people who did not exist. He mentioned their names: Donna Pram, Liz Farmington, Squeaky Jill Messerschmidt, and I recognized the names from memory. At one point, they had all lived in Mason City, Iowa. They were also dead. While talking, my father's pupils were dilated. His eyelids were pulled open, and the eyes themselves were glassy and seemingly focused on some indeterminate point in space. I thought to myself, I'm looking into the heart of those fish eyes. For two whole days, he explained to me he was speaking with dead girlfriends. He said, they want to make sex with me. He also said, they're in the room. Several days later, he lost the fish eyes, and he was well again. Doctors informed me this is merely called sundown syndrome, momentary hallucinations caused in the elderly by nothing more than a change of scenery, like a sudden trip to the hospital or day turning into night. But I wanted to tell you about Daniel Tripps. We found him next door. He had wandered into a bar called Mayslax. Mayslax is regionally famous for promoting and serving a certain type of garlic-dipped roast beef sandwich. Daniel Tripps was eating, and eating with visible pleasure, one of these sandwiches. I witnessed him licking fingers, closing eyes in ecstasy, masticating. At this moment, he began to repeat the sound. We listened. The sound formed a word. The word was now clear. It was easily understandable. His speaking of the word did not seem symptomatic of an illness I could recognize. The word was very simple. The word was meat.
And I should say for listeners that you've got three panels after that of a guy holding a hamburger, what looks like a cow made of boxes, and then just a blank black panel, right? It just trails off.
Right.
And so many of the stories, I mean, they do end in these moments of silence with no resolution.
Right.
How can you leave us with no resolution? No click on the box that tells us what this means or why these two stories were put together.
At this point, as a response, I either boldly assert or cowardly retreat to my earlier assertion about the ways that that I experience stories. Along with the Journal of Concrete Observations, along with gathering fragments, and along with just walking around. That's the predominant feeling to me of so many stories I've heard. And I hesitate to even articulate that because it seems almost kind of pat to say, you know, stories I hear don't have conclusions. And of course, you know, that's not true for everything, but certainly for my observational life. What would be a good example of this? I suppose, while I was researching stories in the book, I'm in the library, and two things happened while I'm in the library. One is if I take him at his word, a recently discharged Afghanistan parachutist finds me and monologues about his troubles. I notice that he's got a hospital plastic wristband with his name and a barcode on it. And he tells me that he's just got out of detox and had some prison trouble. And he sort of mentions his tale and wanders off without much conclusion. He sort of needed to say things to a person. And for a couple of minutes, I was that person. And then he's gone. Then I go down to another part of the stacks, and there's an old man arguing, groaning about the fact that he can't get his copies to come out on the copier, and he's hassling the librarian, getting more volatile. But at that moment, I move away down the stacks. My research draws me elsewhere, and their conversation recedes. And those moments are really – I still think about them weirdly a lot, but they're just stuck there. They're just stuck like so much of all the crap that we take in the course of a day. And for me, I can't get rid of those things. They stick with me, strange moments, and sometimes it feels like they are surrounded by and end in kind of silence. I hope that doesn't get to be a trope or or I lean on that too much, because I think that stories sometimes demand conclusions. But that's probably the best way I can get for it, Eric. I sure wish I had a more satisfying answer.
I think that's a nice, you know, defense in the classic sense of what's going on. The pieces on the page, they feel very compressed and overdetermined, like a dream, and weighted, and it's not a lyric compression.
Right.
They're not things that sing. But I think it's something about the way the space that you give them, they take on a certain kind of weight and gravity that gives them a density. Some of these, you know, go on for a dozen pages, but some of them are 2-3 pages in a book that, you know, can fit in your pocket.
Yes. Well, this is, you know, you're saying so many, to me, fascinating things that are true about the book, about a non-lyric compression, things of that nature. And I'm reminded of perhaps another little footnote to tack on to, you know, your question about, why tell these things in this way. I mean, sometimes, you know, you find a narrator in life, I mean, a person on earth who is narrating, not in the story, but as you meet them in the world, and they have a kind of weird sense of storytelling. And I'm thinking right now, my grandpa Bill, he was just a great guy, and had such an odd way of telling stories. He was not what anyone would call a raconteur or a narrator, but he had these terse little odd prose poem stories, and he told it all, he's from Iowa, and he told it all in this voice that he had from the prairie. And one of those stories that he told is in the book in its entirety, and that's exactly the way he told it, which is, once he described some people that came up to fight him, and both the assailants and my grandfather had their dogs, and the fight happened, and the fight between the dogs happened, and then there was an outcome, and he just ended it. And it didn't have any context. It was just a little nugget of weird terseness that he would deliver, like so many other things that were like less like stories and more like strange little facts. And maybe that style of storytelling is really stuck with me. I always wonder if that's some kind of unconscious seepage listening to our, you know, whatever style we inherit from our fathers and grandparents.
That makes perfect sense. And I want to come back to that. I just want to follow up on the observation that you made. I think a commonplace understanding of the link between sort of stories and self is anecdotal, right? Like dad tells the one at Thanksgiving about the time he made this, and
right.
Oh, that's old grandmother's story about when she lived on the farm, right? And like we link them up with the personality.
Right.
But it's interesting to think about stories that aren't somehow indicative or metonymic of the self. They're just these stories that happen and have an aura to them that is storytelling rather than, you know, pointing towards the person who's telling them.
Right. Yes. I mean, wow. Yeah. There's, I go back and forth on that all the time, thinking about self in one hand and the facts of the story on the other. I think because that's in some ways that's always the problem, is and again, getting back to your question of how does one take fragmentary things. Sure, you can just deliver up the fragments, but also there's an impulse to have some coherence. The piece that I read, The Sound, that's coming from the mouth of a single speaker, doesn't on its face, I don't think, sound all that weird. It's certainly not a surreal or dream piece. But that's the thing, anyway, isn't it? You have this material that's almost like a platonic material. The facts exist in space. Then you think, well, it has to come out of the mouth of a person. Somebody has to say the darn stuff. So who's that person going to be, and what are they going to sound like?
So tell us why they sometimes look like clowns whose facial expressions never change,
right.
Which is a kind of visual that returns throughout the book in several essays. There are these clowns. Sometimes there's one. Sometimes there's two that are in dialogue. Their facial expressions never change.
That's great. For those people who are listening, Eric stepped on the other huge thing about the book is that half of it, the visuals look in some ways classically like comics. They have characters in somewhat dynamic poses doing things on a page, and there's visual dynamism. There's angles and objects and scenes that are changing. And those are always placed smack dab behind the monologue of a single speaker, almost as though you're seeing pictures of a scene that person is describing, or you're seeing pictures of their mind, or you're seeing metaphorical images that correspond to the story. The other half of the book are dialogues, and that was a challenge to me. So again, I'll give you the practical answer and the sort of aesthetic answer, is that when I had these dialogues, suddenly you got two characters, and I couldn't, in the way that I could with a single speaker, throw up onto the page somewhat metaphorical or random images, because I think then that starts, you get two voices and an image of randomness, and there's almost too many competing elements. I tried a few of those, and it's always seemed like there was too much stuff going on. And then the other option that occurred to me is, well, I'll draw a sequence of two guys, and there'll be these two guys that are having a conversation throughout the entire book. But I ran up against a little problem. Like I told you, I was heavily using source photos, and to find source images of two people having a conversation that lasts over a very long time with multiple body postures and angles was beyond my ability to reference. And when I tried using myself as a photo reference, I literally sat down and played the part of two guys changing positions on a chair, leaning in, gesticulating, had all this footage of my dumb mug on my computer as I did all these contortions. And it was too labor intensive. It was just too much. So the practical answer is, I couldn't somehow with these two characters draw them having this book length conversation. And so I went back to something I'd done earlier. I did an essay for a website called Essay Daily, which was essentially kind of a book report about this great Tarkovsky book, Andrei Tarkovsky, Russian filmmaker. And I just had these, I was fascinated by these clown head images. There was a couple old coin-operated banks, these movable, almost, what would you call them? Movable banks. People made these things back at the turn of the century where you'd put a coin in and, say it was a circus scene, and you'd put a coin in and, turn the monkey's tail and the coin would flip up and go into the bank reservoir and stuff like that. And there were these two clowns that were banks, and I took a couple pictures of them, found them in the Minneapolis Institute of Art, and then just sat with the images and would every once in a while look at them. And they came in my mind – this answer is getting way too long. I'm going to cut to the quick really, really soon. But these guys came in my mind to sort of represent kind of a – I don't know, Tweedledee and Tweedledum of academic discussion. the essay that I wrote, I needed to be characters speaking because I couldn't with any authority say a thing and make points as like one person. I needed to sort of puncture and prod myself and either support myself or cut myself out when I was saying things. And these little, sort of static puppet heads seemed like great stand-ins. they were mildly amusing to me, and I liked the effect. They had a wonderful, hilarious blankness, almost like they were actors in some sort of Beckett play. Beckett loved static heads coming out of jars and saying things, and so yeah, I just repurposed them for the book because I thought, well, when they're speaking, you can be darn sure that you know which guy is speaking, so it takes care of that problem. And they discuss philosophy and life and do so in either dumb or illuminating ways, and they seemed like great stand-ins.
Yeah, I think they definitely have this kind of Laurel and Hardy relationship on the one hand, then they have eerie clown relationship on the other hand. It's multidimensional. I think one of the things the book is achieves so nicely, and the clowns do this as well, because again, their facial expressions don't change.
Right.
Is how much you can achieve through a minimalist gesture. So as the dialogue unfolds, I can't help but sort of imagine and ascribe things to the faces. The faces change despite the fact that the graphic on the page does not.
Right.
And you somehow manage to get my eye to focus in other essays on blank sections.
Yes.
As long as I do on the sections that have what other people might describe as content. And that was one of the reasons I was so excited. Like, how can he make nothing do so much?
That was a happy accident. And really, it was, once you say to yourself, all you have for an image reservoir or image palette are either three things, clown A, clown B, or blackness, you say to yourself, well, I guess I'll play with blackness. And this goes back to the comics as theater. It's not a great analogy, but I sure love that comics shape time. Or writers do this, text writers do this with white space on the page. I mean, it's not exclusively a domain of comics, but silence is great. Silence when, someone's speaking, like I am, I'm just a floatsome log jam of words right now with no ceasing. God, would it be nice to have some silence in there to reflect? And when that happens, it's like a holy moment. It just takes whatever is around it and makes it interesting. You know, pauses in theater where there's just the actors on the stage lit in a certain way. That's beautiful. And happy accident. As I was mucking around with these clown heads, it seemed like there were times of rest that were necessary. And maybe it'd be nice for like two or three panels for a clown head to simply stare into the void. And once I saw that, I it felt right. And it gives almost a performative quality to, I think, to some of their inane dialogue. So they could do that. That sort of moment of gaping reflection. So yeah, I'm glad you dug that.
And not entirely inane. Not entirely inane. In fact, what I want to do is I don't know if this you might just say, LeMay, you've already answered this question, but I want to describe the book entirely differently from how we've been doing so far.
Yeah.
Because I think if somebody came up to me and described the book in this way, I would say, yes. Well, yes, that's accurate. And the reason I want to do that is because I think the book is incredibly rich and we're getting kind of one avant-garde perspective on how the content works and what it might be. But I can imagine a reader coming up and saying something like, this is a book with a heavy sense of place, right? Sometimes it's Iowa, sometimes it's a river district.
Yes.
It's a book that's grounded in a certain kind of community, right? Yes. It's an immigrant community, a Slovakian community. It also has a really tight sense of time. It's got a unity of kind of it's old timers or the olden days. It's when men wore fedoras. So there's, now we've got a book that has those classic unities of time and place and character. And to me, it does have all of that richness.
That's so kind of you. It's funny. Yeah, we talk about avant-garde, but you come back to the same stuff. You come back to places on Earth and people on Earth and all that. That's very well said. I mean, it's certainly, I'm glad that those things emerge. Very happy that you were able to latch on to that. Because it's this all circles back to that nonfiction idea. And the pleasure of stories, geez, it must begin for so many of people in hearing about their own families. And certainly that was just a giant reservoir of stuff for me in this book, was thinking about the old tales and people that are gone and the kinds of worlds they talked about. And it's weird. It's two generations and already those things seem like phantasms or impossibilities, almost the things people did and the way they lived. I'm glad that you felt that, because certainly all those things, place, older people, older communities. That was high in my mind as I was making this book. Mm-hmm.
The title essay, "River Dead of Minneapolis Scavenged by Teens." I mean, I think you could describe it fairly enough. Maybe you'll disagree. Here's this portrait of this small boy and a portrait of a river and a town, and it's kind of this devastating character portrait, which is, you know, what we started off saying. Well, this book isn't really interested in character in the same way, but it does. It feels like you've got, you know, boy on the river, swimming in the river, right, with the kind of all the complexity of coming of age, and suddenly I felt like I was in a different genre.
Oh, that's cool. I'm equally glad that that's, you know, all accessible. I think that the fact that those moments come through, you say, like, you know, the idea of a coherent person, you know, maybe that's, you know, still in some ways, despite collage or fragmentary things, the best way or a great way to deliver fragmentary narrative is by having it in a person that, or a voice, if one doesn't believe in the construct or the person, a voice that feels like it's speaking out of some real need. And I think that was the case for that piece. I'd read this great, man, old libraries, they're your friend. I go to them all the time. Used to go to the Minnesota History Center Library, filled with just great, bizarre tomes and registries of patients who had lived in psychiatric hospitals. And then you find these little home-published memoirs, and there was one of them by this guy who was like some Northeast Minneapolis alderman. And he just described life on the river in the 30s. And he said that, you know, his family was poor, so he did a lot of scavenging. He talked about taverns in that time would have their own currency, like tavern tokens, and these would get occasionally dumped in the river, and then he would dredge those out and sell them, or he would, you know, grab pigeons from rafters and things like that. But he also talked at a lot of length and with great love, almost kind of a creepy love, about finding dead guys in the river. And what he would take from them, and, you know, they had, you know, jewelry or things, scavenging the dead bodies. And and I guess as the story came to be written, it felt maybe right to have someone speaking about the day when the pleasure of scavenging dead people would come to an end, and a person had to find a job and become part of society. So I certainly didn't think that maybe explicitly writing it, but it on the outside end of it, it feels like that's exactly what happened.
Well, Edgar Allan Poe alerted us a long time ago with his little essay on the Raven, the philosophy of composition, that what artists are doing behind the scenes and what emerges are two different things. And, you know,
yes,
don't think that the artist had that all in mind as it was taking place.
Right. Oh, gosh.
But
yes,
the beauty is what ends up coming out of the process and the encounter with it, which I couldn't say enough for about this book. I want to make sure that readers search it out. You're not going to find it next to the Marvel comics. But it is worth finding out, and we'll put some information on our website for readers to do that. But I would be curious to hear, before we finish talking, where you're going now. I mean, the new book is out.
Yes, the new book is out. You know, I'm making some small local appearances here in Minneapolis to support it. Probably the biggest thing I did, I self-published the book, you know, and so that is both liberating and gives you a ton of controls over things that I love about book arts, you know, the feel of the paper, the cover stock, and the sort of the hue of the interior paper, all those sort of a book arts control freak things you can have. But of course, you know, the headaches of self-publishing as well, you know, just simply getting the
Mark, I think we've lost you. I'm going to try to call you back.
Thank you. Are we live, Eric?
We are live.
I just wanted to say it's so awesome that I was cut off, because the very comment that I was talking about was how it feels like an extreme act of narcissism to self-promote and self-publish. So I think it was so beautiful that that's the moment that I just disappeared off the face of the planet from an audio perspective. That was awesome.
Well, that's the worry. And I you know, one of the reasons I was excited about doing this was to alert potential readers to the book, because it's hard to find. But I did not know that in the world of kind of graphic literary art, there is this small community of people that are publishing and supporting one another. And
yes.
It's so artistically rich.
Yes.
And it gives you access to this body of work that's, you know, has, I think, kind of the particularities, but also the richness of, say, America's poetry scene or something like that. But it's
right.
Hard to find.
It is. It is hard to find. I think a person needs to, well, there's a couple things to say about that. One is, you know, God, I love text literature. That stuff is great. It's so awesome. I also have to say, and a complaint with it is that world, and maybe it's the medium, I've never decided this, but that world seems a little, just a hair less inclusive. And I wonder if that isn't because the very nature of text is forcing us, because all the visually, a good book and a bad book look exactly the same. I'm talking about the guts of a book, not the cover or the book design. You know, they're words on a page, printed words, give or take a few design elements, that we aren't automatically forced to a sort of higher, deeper, critical level with text. You know, they're the same thing. Words on a page, but then we have to probe them and say, did I get a feeling out of this? Did I, is it saying something interesting? This could be a total bullshit theory too, but, you know, I feel that with comics, there's sort of a it is what it is kind of quality in that community. And of course, yes, there's worlds of criticism to talk about this drawing style or that drawing style as being bad, or this artist is not being elevated and being a, you know, this artist is a lesser artist, all that stuff. But, you know, I guess it just comes out of that culture. You have these things like zine fests, you know, people that staple stuff at a FedEx office in, you know, with little hand-drawn comics. And those are a big part of that culture, little obscure creators making these sometimes crudely drawn things. And they're sort of cherished in a way, I think, that crudely written texts aren't cherished in the culture. And so, yeah, that's there. You know, you'll find these places on Tumblr. There's communities that support comics there, and these little conferences and zine fests and all that stuff. So yeah, maybe there's, you know, I don't know. Again, I'm wading into super, tenuous territory here, trying to bolster my arguments about text versus comics, but that may be something.
Well, you don't have to put yourself in a position to kind of, discredit literary America.
Thank you.
For not further embracing it. We can just say that there is some amazing work out there, and some of the comics that you talk about in your writing are ones that readers can hunt down through just a quick Google. But
this is true.
The upshot is that there's tremendously rich aesthetic work that we need to find a way to get to.
Oh, agreed. And I think the best thing to do is to, and P.S., before I advance to the next comment, I need you as a PR consultant to follow me whenever I'm about to slag a swath of millions of people. that would be very helpful to have you at my back to redirect in a very helpful way my sentiments. The best way to do this, man, you know, pop online, go into a comic store, whatever, and as soon as you find artists you like, isn't it the truth? I mean, you just sort of find places where they've been, magazines they've appeared, and you just start, the world start opening up. You know, one person who's curating a blog has an artist that you like on it, and then you find that person's curatorial tastes are totally awesome. And there's a whole host of other, great artists. And God, they just keep coming. I mean, one can't keep up with how many cool, interesting writers and illustrators and artists there are out there. So the internet is a blessing in that way.
That sounds like a wonderful note on which to close. Thank you so much, Mark, for your time with us and for sharing your work.
You are so welcome. Thank you for having me.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Mark Ealy, the author of River Dead of Minneapolis, Scavenged by Teens, the New Books Network.